The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And it is Thanksgiving week, and we're reading from the Week magazine, dated November 23rd, 2012. And we hope it's a very happy Thanksgiving week for you as well. Thanks for joining me today. We begin, as usual, with the main story section of the Week magazine. And our first article is entitled, Sex Scandal Rocks the CIA. What happened? The National Security Establishment was thrown into turmoil this past week after a spiraling sex scandal forced the resignation of CIA Director David Petraeus and entangled General John Allen, the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan. Petraeus, who is 60 years old, acknowledged extremely poor judgment in cheating on his wife of 38 years and conducting an affair with his biographer, Paula Broadwell, who is 40 years old. The affair came to light after a jealous Broadwell sent threatening anonymous emails to Jill Kelly, a 37-year-old Tampa socialite and volunteer event organizer for the Military Central Command, accusing her of flirting with Petraeus. Kelly complained about the emails to a friend at the FBI, and the agency opened an investigation. Agents traced the emails back to Broadwell and then discovered her sexually explicit correspondence with the CIA chief. Both Petraeus and Broadwell admitted their affair, but the FBI found no breach of security or evidence of criminality, and the agency and Attorney General Eric Holder decided not to inform Congress or President Obama. But the FBI agent, who was a friend of Kelly, complained of a cover-up to Republican House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, who called the FBI in late October. Soon afterward, James Clapper, Director of National Intelligence, told Petraeus to step down. Congressional intelligence committees are demanding to know why they were kept in the dark, and the Pentagon has launched an investigation into Allen, who the FBI found had exchanged thousands of flirtatious emails with Kelly. Now here's what the editorial said. Petraeus' resignation is a serious blow to the nation's national security leadership. But he had to go, said the Washington Post. He was utterly reckless in communicating with his mistress through an insecure Gmail account, an act that disqualifies him as head of the CIA. Petraeus's foolishness is flabbergasting, said Bloomberg.com. Why, oh, why on earth did one of the smartest men in the country, a military innovator who recast our Iraq strategy and ran the agency that tracked down Osama bin Laden, think his romantic emails could remain secret? More importantly, why did law enforcement officials wait weeks before telling Obama that Petraeus was compromised? Asked the Wall Street Journal. It seems strange, not to say politically convenient, that Holder kept this problem bottled up until President Obama was safely reelected. Congress must conduct a thorough investigation of the scandal's handling. No one wants to see Petraeus or his family further humiliated, but there are security implications that need to be explained. Now here's what the columnist said. Petraeus made a very human mistake, but his resignation should have been rejected, said Trudy Rubin in the Philadelphia Inquirer. As commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, he promoted a counterinsurgency strategy that prevented an even more grisly civil war. Why then, at a time when the CIA plays a critical role in anti-terrorism operations in Pakistan, Libya, Syria, and throughout the world, should the country lose his skills? We were better off in the days when national leaders were judged on performance and their private lives remained just that. Petraeus's famously large ego may have done him in, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. He was known for cultivating acolytes, and Broadwell first came to him as a brainy, super fit, and glamorous West Point graduate who wanted to do her doctorate on his leadership style. She was exactly the sort of aspiring officer intellectual that Petraeus was keen to mentor. In the course of working together on their fawning biography, all in the education of David Petraeus, she may have made herself irresistible. The real scandal here isn't sex. It's what we've learned about America's unaccountable surveillance state, said Glenn Greenwald in Guardian.co.uk. Based on a few nasty emails, the FBI was able to access all of Broadwell's email accounts, dig into Petraeus' Gmail, and examine 30,000 pages of digital correspondence between Allen and Kelly. They did all this intrusive snooping without the need for any warrant from a court. What strange justice this is. The crown prince of America's national security state has just been consumed by the very system he thought he controlled. Now the next item from the main story section of the Week magazine, Obama's hard line on the fiscal cliff. President Obama signaled that he was ready to drive a hard bargain with the Congress on the fiscal cliff last week, opening talks on the looming crisis with a proposal to raise taxes on the wealthiest Americans in order to generate $1.6 trillion more revenue over the next 10 years. The president began negotiations with House Republicans on his $4 trillion deficit reduction plan, which also includes major spending cuts and some savings in Medicare and Medicaid. As the nation races toward the fiscal cliff, the combination of expiring tax cuts and automatic spending cuts set to kick in after December 31st. Economists warn that if all the Bush tax cuts expire and mandated spending cuts are carried out, about $600 billion will be sucked out of the economy next year, throwing it into a recession. The president urged Congress to pass a bill right now preserving the Bush-era tax cuts for the 98% of Americans who earn less than $250,000 a year. We should not hold the middle class hostage while we debate tax cuts for the wealthy, he said. Republican House Speaker John Boehner indicated a new willingness to increase federal revenues through closing loopholes or comprehensive tax reform, but said raising taxes was unacceptable. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell accused Obama of thumbing his nose at the GOP, but said Republicans would accept new revenues in exchange for meaningful reforms to the entitlement programs that are primary drivers of our debt. Now here's what the editorial said. Elections have consequences, said the New York Times. Raising taxes on the wealthiest Americans is what Obama campaigned on and won on. Yet John Boehner's Republicans are resurrecting proposals his party already offered and voters rejected. As we all know, the GOP has a taste for political extortion, but Obama has voters on his side and the upper hand. It is important that he stand firm. You're forgetting something, said the Boston Herald. The House remains in the hands of a majority of Republicans, and they won elections too. Are they expected to just abandon their commitment to voters? The country is still divided on taxes, said the Wall Street Journal. Exit polls found that Americans dismissed the idea of raising taxes to cut the deficit by nearly 2-1. Obama may think he can bludgeon Republicans until they give in, but a bipartisan compromise is the only way to avoid a fiscal and political crash. Now here's what the columnist said. Obama has a foolproof option for dealing with Republican intransigence, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. Just say no and go over the cliff if necessary. The fiscal cliff isn't a solid deadline. Tax hikes can be repealed retroactively without costing taxpayers a dime, and the economy wouldn't begin hurting until several months into 2013. There's time to bargain. Already cracks have appeared in the Republicans' wall of opposition to raising taxes, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. Even Weekly Standard editor Bill Kristol said this week it won't kill the country if we raise taxes on millionaires. The GOP shouldn't cave, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. The president needs a deal far more than they do. A prolonged standoff would batter the economy, crippling his second-term agenda before it's even started. Congress, meanwhile, has little to lose. But can Americans count on House Republicans to hold the line, said Michael Tanner in NationalReview.com. Boehner has already signaled he'd accept additional revenue, giving up precious leverage before negotiations even began. Having conceded on taxes, what does he have left to trade? Republicans can't win this fight, said Matthew Iglesias in Slate.com. There's no leverage on the GOP side and nothing for the parties to negotiate over. If Obama does nothing, then all the Bush tax cuts will expire on January 1. Then Democrats can pass their bill to extend just the middle class tax hikes and dare the GOP to commit suicide by blocking it. Boehner can bluff all he likes about resisting tax increases now. Come January, it will be game over. Now from the main story section, we'll turn to the controversy of the week, political spending, why the super PACs flopped. Money can't buy happiness, said Michael Ishikoff in NBCNews.com. And apparently, it can't buy an election either. Thanks to the Supreme Court's controversial decisions to strike down campaign finance laws in such cases as Citizens United, the recent presidential election was the first in which wealthy contributors and corporations could donate unlimited sums of money to super PACs, political action committees set up to advocate for candidates and parties. Big checks flooded in, but it turns out the super donors didn't get much for their money. The pro-Mitt Romney super PAC, Restore Our Future, spent $143 million on a losing cause. Casino mogul Sheldon Adelson threw away $20 million on Newt Gingrich's failed primary campaign, and then another $33 million on Romney's campaign and nine Republican congressional candidates, eight of whom lost. GOP strategist Karl Rove's American Crossroads Group spent $175.8 million on attack ads this cycle, but only one of the 10 Democrats he targeted lost. All told, said Dan Egan in the Washington Post, the super PACs wasted more than $1 billion trying to influence voters. Never before has so much political money been spent to achieve so little. The super PAC's failure doesn't prove that money can't buy or influence elections, said David Weigel in Slate.com. It only proves that money spent on really stupid attack ads doesn't influence elections. Voters in Ohio, for instance, were bombarded with amateurish cartoons in which caricatures of Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown rubber stamped supposedly job-killing legislation while sitting at a desk with an I Love Taxes coffee mug. Many other super PAC attack ads were just as lazy and patronizing. There were also far too many of them, said David Horsey in the Los Angeles Times. More than 1 million ads were aired in total, and in Ohio and other crucial swing states, the colossal spending spree reached a saturation point after which voters simply could not absorb any more negative advertising. If you think that means Citizens United doesn't matter, said Eric Posner in Slate.com, you're mistaken. When a partisan billionaire like Adelson donates tens of millions to a Republican super PAC, what he's really buying is influence over the entire party, including incumbent senators and congressmen who want Adelson's backing for their own next campaigns. More insidiously, Adelson is also potentially influencing Democrats in Congress who know that if they're too aggressive in promoting policies Adelson doesn't like, he might start writing fat checks to whoever runs against them. Money will always find its way into politics, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. So let's stop playing super PAC games and let donors contribute unlimited amounts directly to candidates. In hindsight, the presidential race was won in the early summer when the Obama campaign spent more than $100 million in swing states to portray Mitt Romney as Gordon Gekko without the social conscience. Romney's campaign was low on cash after his primary battle, and he was forbidden by law from coordinating with the super PACs that could have fought back on his behalf. The real problem this year wasn't too much campaign spending, but too little. Liberal Chicken Littles said all that spending would make the sky fall, but it didn't, said George Will in the Washington Post. Voters in swing states were engaged and informed, and the election was hotly contested and highly competitive. More spending on political advocacy means more voter information and interest, and that's always a good thing for our democracy. Now let's turn to the popular column, Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. In the Week magazine this week, it was a good week for slow and steady after a tortoise from Alamogordo, New Mexico, that went missing from its home was found 10 days later, 50 miles away. It was a good week for cheap praise after a Japanese study found that compliments can help improve student and employee performance as much as monetary rewards. To the brain, receiving a compliment is as much a social reward as being rewarded money, said researcher Norihiro Sadato. And it was a good week for bipartisanship after Millicent O.R. of Kenya named her newborn twin sons Barack and Mitt. Giving her sons those names, she said, would help her remember the historic U.S. elections for a long time, both the winner and the loser. It was a bad week for Molson after beer sales for the brewing company took a big drop in Canada because of the NHL lockout. Canadians drink substantial quantities of beer while watching games in bars and at home, and Molson also uses hockey games to promote its brand. It was a bad week for outreach after the Philadelphia Inquirer found that Mitt Romney got not a single vote in 59 districts of that Pennsylvania city. The vote total in those heavily African-American Democratic districts, Obama 19,604 and Romney nothing. And it was a bad week for false hope after Mitt Romney's campaign briefly activated a website for President-elect Romney, which promised a quick repeal of Obamacare. On its job applicant page, the site warned, "Government service is not for everyone." Now we'll turn to the briefing section in the Week magazine for this Thanksgiving week. The article is entitled, "The Next Afghanistan." The terrorist group Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb has seized control of a swath of North Africa. Is it a real threat? What are the group's goals? Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb is an independent offshoot of Al-Qaeda that's fighting to implement an extremist version of Islamic rule across North Africa. Founded during the bitter Algerian civil war of the 1990s, the organization was once known for the Salafist group, or known as the Salafist group, for preaching and combat. But in the early 2000s, the Algerian government launched a highly effective amnesty program for former insurgents, throwing the outfit into disarray. Deprived of recruits, the group in 2006 boosted its profile by joining Osama bin Laden's global jihad and rebranding itself as Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. The Maghreb is the arid region that stretches across North Africa from Morocco to Libya. AQIM's ambitions seemed mostly local until last year, but Hillary Clinton recently declared the group a threat to the entire region and to the world. What changed? The overthrow of Libyan dictator Muammar al-Qaddafi destabilized the region. Thousands of nomadic Tuareg tribesmen who had served as mercenaries in the dictator's army returned to northern Mali, bringing rebellion and a vast arsenal of weapons with them. Eager to establish their own ethnic homeland, the former mercenaries drove out the Malian army with the help of AQIM, or AQUIM, fighters and other radical Islamists from neighboring Algeria. But after that victory, AQIM turned on the mostly secular Tuaregs, chasing them off and seizing an area the size of Texas. When the West started fighting in Libya, did you think of all the consequences in the region? No, said a senior Malian security official. Some 450,000 people have fled northern Mali. Amid reports of the implementation of Sharia law, musicians have been threatened with amputation for playing instruments, and unmarried couples have been stoned to death for having sex. Why does Mali matter to us? Officials in Washington fear that the northern part of the country could soon resemble Afghanistan before 2001, a wild tribal area where fundamentalist groups are free to train terrorists for operations abroad. Northern Mali is the perfect spot for a violent anti-Western group to set up headquarters. Its inhospitable Saharan dunes host some of the world's busiest drug and gun smuggling routes and provide strong natural defenses against any would-be invaders. There are already signs that AQIM is using its new home to spread chaos across the North African region. The head of the U.S. African Command, General Carter Ham, has warned that the outfit is training fighters from Nigeria's Boko Haram, an extremist Islamist group that has killed thousands of people in recent years. U.S. intelligence officials are also looking into whether AQIM is linked to the September 11th attack on the American consulate in Benghazi, Libya, which killed Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans. The Al-Qaeda group, or was the Al-Qaeda group, involved in Benghazi? Well, that's still not entirely clear. U.S. intelligence officials believe that some members of Ansar al-Sharia, the Libyan Islamist group thought to have carried out the assault, have ties to AQIM. In the hours after the deadly raid, American spy agencies intercepted electronic communications from Ansar al-Sharia fighters, bragging about their exploits to an AQIM operative. But intelligence officials still have no firm evidence that the attack was actually directed by AQIM, and some experts doubt that the group has the ability to organize such an assault. AQIM has always been way more talk than action, said a former U.S. senior official. How has Washington reacted? The Obama administration has stepped up military aid to Mali's neighbors, and together with France, Mali's former colonial ruler, has offered to help train and finance an African intervention force. So far, the 15-nation alliance, known as the Economic Community of West African States, has agreed to provide 3,300 soldiers to bolster Mali's army and confront the Islamists. But no offensive is likely before March, said Anwar Bukhars, a Middle East scholar with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, because it will take months to turn Mali's ragtag army into an effective fighting force. In the meantime, said a senior U.S. counterterrorism official, the White House has begun considering the use of armed drones. And the footnote to this particular article is the hostage economy. Since 2008, AQIM is estimated to have raised more than $80 million by seizing and ransoming off dozens of Western tourists, aid workers, and employees of multinational companies. but the group won't snatch just any Westerner. The terrorists prefer continental Europeans, said U.S. anti-terrorism official David Cohen, because they understand they will not receive ransoms from the American and British governments. That selective strategy is paying off. Sergey Daniel, author of Aquem, The Kidnapping Industry, says that Spain has handed over at least $11.5 million to free its citizens in recent years, while Germany and Austria have together paid up to $10.9 million. Such payments only encourage Aquem to seize more European hostages and demand more for them, said Cohen. The average ransom payment per hostage rose from $4.5 million in 2010 to $5.4 million a year later. Kidnapping for ransom, he said, has become our most significant terrorist financing threat today. And you're listening to our reading of the Week magazine for the week of November 23rd, 2012, Thanksgiving week. And whether you're listening on Thanksgiving Day or on one of our repeat broadcasts this weekend, I hope you're having a wonderful time with your family and friends and giving thanks for all the great things we have in this country. Now we'll turn to the best columns of the week in the United States, according to The Week magazine. Our first column is entitled Facing Up to the Welfare State by Robert Samuelson in The Washington Post. If you doubt America is a welfare state, said Robert Samuelson, consider the numbers. Last year, payments for individuals, programs such as Medicaid, Social Security, Medicare, and food stamps made up 65% of federal spending, up from 21% in 1955. More than half the country is receiving government benefits. That's the welfare state. It will grow larger under Obamacare, with families of four making up to $91,000 qualifying for insurance subsidies. Yet the subject is virtually taboo. Americans hate to admit that they're getting handouts, so we call them entitlements or assistance instead. The welfare state has alleviated poverty and cushioned recessions, but its programs have strayed from their original purpose. Social Security, for example, was created to keep the elderly from going hungry. Now it also provides $50,000 a year to affluent seniors to subsidize their latest trip to Europe. To reduce our potentially ruinous $1 trillion of annual deficit, we must get the welfare state under control. But to do that, first, we need to admit it exists. The next column is entitled The GOP's Big City Problem, and it's written by Lydia DePillis in TNR.com. Republicans can't afford to ignore cities anymore, said Lydia DePillis. That's one of the lessons of the 2012 election results, in which the big cities in battleground states such as Ohio, Colorado, Florida, Virginia, and Pennsylvania voted overwhelmingly for President Obama and the Democrats. Since the 1960s, Republicans have disdainfully dismissed big cities as bastions of crime and welfare while selling an anti-government, individualistic vision to suburban and rural voters. But in recent years, cities have changed. Young people, the affluent, and the highly educated have flocked to cities by the millions, and today cities are centers of innovation and entrepreneurship, competition, and the creation of wealth. Because they live in such close quarters, city dwellers rely on government to provide mass transit, street cleaning, snow removal, schools, and protection from crime. They see government not as an evil, but as a necessity for the public good. They're also more diverse and more tolerant than red America, and open to social change. To have a chance to win in many battleground states, Republicans will need to get over their cultural aversion to the metropolis. It's where America's future is growing. And the third column for this week, Why Obama Will Ignore Israel, by Thomas L. Friedman in the New York Times. My president is busy, said Thomas Friedman. That's what I tell Israeli friends who worry that President Obama will now punish Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu for his open support of Mitt Romney. The sad truth is that the newly reelected president doesn't have the time, energy, and political capital to spend on Israeli-Palestinian relations. He has serious work to do at home regarding the economy, the deficit, and taxes, and Americans have lost interest in foreign quagmires. Meanwhile, Netanyahu has made it clear that he's not interested in resolving Israel's conflict with the Palestinians. Indeed, he has provocatively supported new settlements in the West Bank and Jerusalem. When President Mahmoud Abbas of the Palestinian Authority recently sent a big signal that he might forego the right of return, claims of Palestinian refugees, Bibi scorned it. With so much on his agenda, why would Obama waste any more time on a problem with no evident solution? It's not a backlash from Washington you should fret about, my Israeli friends. It's much worse than you think. You are home alone. Now, from the Week magazine for this week, we'll flip to the back of the magazine and look at the last word. This week, the title of the last word article is The Roots of Football. In the factory towns where pro football began, says Rich Cohen, violence was always part of the game. William Pudge Heffelfinger was America's first professional football player. Paid $500 to man the line for the Allegheny Athletic Club in Pittsburgh's Recreation Park. That game, which was played on November 12, 1892, was just a scrum in the mud, less sport than brawl. You took an elbow, spit some teeth, drove on. But 120 years later, professional football, the closest thing we have to a national pastime, the NFL brings in $9 billion a year, is on a kind of precipice, with stories about brain injuries and medical issues suddenly competing for newspaper inches with the games themselves. The worry is not just that people will stop watching the game, it's that parents will stop letting their kids play, starving the league of talent. Speaking on The Tonight Show, Terry Bradshaw, the great Pittsburgh Steelers cornerback, predicted the demise of football, saying that if he had a son, he would not let him sign up. The fear of them getting these head injuries, he explained, it's just too great for me. I did not play tackle football and won't let my sons play, in part because I fear my grandma Esther was right. It will rattle your brains. But I love to watch. The nastier the better. It's a guilty pleasure. I like it when you hit a guy just right, shake him up so bad you see little snot bubbles, as the once feared linebacker Brian Bosworth said. The NFL can pass as many rules to protect players as it wants, but the blindside knockout remains paramount, a practice just as popular with the teenagers who are getting this from high school football or youth football, said Chris Nowinski, the former Harvard football player. Nowinski works with the Boston University Brain Bank, where doctors have pioneered the study of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which afflicts so many retired players. The day we can diagnose them while they're alive, he says, will be a day we'll have to ask the world what percentage of kids is allowable to have this disease from playing a sport. I decided to take a trip to pro football country to trace the sport's history, but most of all, to determine if violence is part of its DNA. I'd become conflicted about my love of the game. My favorite team has long been the 1985 Bears, which featured the most brutal defense in the NFL history. But as the findings have come in from the Boston Brain Bank, my pleasure has kinked and complicated. By returning to the sport's early sacred sites, I hope to reconnect with the mythic superstructure of the game and test my faith in football. starting in Connecticut. I followed Interstate 87 west across the Tappan Zee Bridge, then headed into New Jersey, Springsteen country, warehouses and weeds drifting across my windows. Pro football was popular in factory towns from the start, and many of the first professionals were miners, milltowners, dead-end boys. Most began playing primitive variations of the game on abandoned plots in the scrub grass between the factory sheds. The Pennsylvania Turnpike goes right by Carlisle, but the toll booth operator had never heard of Jim Thorpe or the school he made famous early last century. Thorpe was 16 when he enrolled. It was called the Carlisle Indian Industrial School, then a Dickensian setup meant to prepare Native Americans for a life in the machine trades. It's where Thorpe carried his first football, began to sprint, hurdle, throw the javelin. Many still consider him the best athlete the United States has ever produced. The stadium where Thorpe played survives, a grassy field overlooked by a grandstand of the old looming variety. White men filled the bleachers on Saturday afternoons, excited to watch Indian teams fight, a spectacle that a few decades before could be seen only in a Wild West show or in an actual battle. Thorpe was the star of the first great pro team, the Canton, Ohio Bulldogs. He was also the NFL's original commissioner. He gave the league a uniquely American identity. Whereas baseball descended from fey British roots, like rounders, pro football began with a big Indian gambling across a field. Thorpe was a sad figure by the time he played for Canton. The gold medal he had won in Stockholm at the 1912 Olympics, having been stripped by the Olympic Committee, which claimed that a summer of semi-pro baseball had invalidated his amateur status. He was drunk a lot of the time. In his later days, Thorpe, who worked as a barroom bouncer, a ditch digger, and an extra playing Indians in B-movies, was a premonition of all those broken gridiron heroes who could find no perch after their last down had been played. There has always been an implicit bargain for football players. They trade tomorrow for right now, handing their middle years over to their youthful selves to devour in the course of a few seasons. The road to Pittsburgh leads through tunnels and past towns, and the city appears all at once, a scrim of bridges and buildings stained to a deep mottled rust. The first pro leagues began here, in sooty towns that stud bituminous mountains, first as a recreation for workers, a diversion between shift whistles, then as factory squads that became competitive to the point of cheating, which meant ringers playing under assumed names, paid under the table, until those teams outgrew the mills and the leagues were organized. The Packers, who joined the NFL in its second season, are now the last of the factory town teams. I made two stops on my way out of Pittsburgh. Beaver Falls, the birthplace of Joe Namath, the great New York Jets quarterback, and Aliquippa, the hometown of legendary Bears coach Mike Ditka. The great Baltimore Colts quarterback Johnny Unitas worked on a road crew in Aliquippa. It might be the bleakest place I've ever seen. Once the booming home of J&L Steel, it began its decline when the mill closed in the 1980s. Just about every store on Main Street is boarded. The people who remain appear trapped. The high school is on a hill above the town. The football field is in a valley below, ratty, rocky, surrounded by row houses built for workers who died a generation ago. In such places, it can seem men have just one thing to offer, their bodies, which they fed to the factories and to the game of football. What happens to such a place when the world changes? When an economy which had been about bodies and brains gives the way to an economy about brains alone? In Aliquippa, you realize that the violence of the sport is not something that evolved, but was a point of the game from the very beginning. The hitting, a cure for every kind of mood. The way when you are so slow, you have to reach up to touch bottom. Nothing beats getting drunk, going to town, and picking a fight with a man twice your size. For some, pro football's appeal is the aerial assault, the ballet of receivers getting both feet in bounds, but for many of us, it's the Stone Age pleasure of watching large men battle to the point of exhaustion. The country opens up as you cross into Ohio, the gloomy mill towns giving way to corn and silos, farms that stretch to the horizon. The Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton had my car in its tractor beam. This is where the league was really formed, in the showroom of Ralph Hayes Hupmobile dealership in 1920. The team owners, the Bears, George Halas among them, sitting on the running boards of the sedans. The exhibit begins with a statue of Thorpe and continues through displays of old equipment, cleats, jerseys, football pants, and most tellingly, helmets, which evolve from none at all to leather, plastic, then whatever space-age material they've made of now. Ironically, football may have gotten more dangerous as helmets have improved, in part because the helmet itself has become the game's most devastating weapon, in part because a man who feels invulnerable plays with the kind of abandon that results in nicknames like the human missile. Canton's Holy of Holies is a dimly lit circular room lined with busts of the anointed. The mood in this room, where grown men in their jerseys wander among stone heads, somber, serious, even a little sad, is not unlike the mood at national memorials, the Lincoln Monument, say where we bear witness to some crucial American moment. To some, football is a religion, a shared history of victories and defeats. Perhaps the sadness in the hall comes from the sense that even religions, especially pagan ones, can die. When I called a few old-time gridiron men, they spoke of football as already gone, their sport having evolved from the ball-control game of their youth into a kind of basketball on grass. The phrase "already gone" was striking, as it seemed to suggest not just changes in the game, but the death of the hardscrabble towns that gave pro football its first ethos. These men were dismissive of new rules meant to protect quarterbacks and receivers. The crack back block, the forearm shiver, the clothesline, the head slap that sent stars turning not unpleasantly around your helmet. Getting hurt has always been a part of it, they explained. Had the injuries gotten so much worse? No one really knows, because no one bothered to examine the veterans of the 33 Giants or the 46 Bears or the 64 Packers, who became bewildered or angry in retirement or made a spectacle of themselves at alumni dinners. Football is violent by design, they told me. It became a sensation because of television, yes, but also because it expressed certain truths about American life. The dangers of the mines and mills, dirt, struggle, blood, grime, the division of labor, the all importance of the clock. But we've changed, which is why white middle and upper middle class fans recoil at the cascade of injuries that can make ESPN resemble the Surgery Channel. Not because football is different, nor because the injuries have gotten so much worse, but because we're becoming increasingly careful as our society has become increasingly safe. We've lost our tolerance for risk. Football is the perfect game for the country America used to be. The sun was going down when I left the hall in Canton, Ohio. There was a gridiron near the entrance, the kind of field I would have quarterbacked all over when I was a kid, running my brother through the classic patterns, the button hook, the post, the down and in. And yes, there were kids out there in the gloaming playing with the same wild, loose-limbed joy I remembered from identical evenings 30 years back. I went over in the hope of talking my way into the game. I walked slowly and just as deliberately as Johnny Unitas headed to the huddle. head down, going through each play in his mind, conjuring, as if by determination alone, that last winning drive. Then, when I got closer, I realized they were kicking a soccer ball. And that article was written by Rick Cohen, copyrighted this year, 2012, originally ran in the magazine The New Republic. Now, from The Last Word, we'll turn to the health and science section of the Week magazine for this Thanksgiving week in 2012. The first article is entitled, The Mirror as a Window on the Heart. Appearances aren't always deceiving. People who look older than others, their age, are more likely to have heart problems than that can or shorten their lives. Danish researchers track the health and physical appearance of 11,000 people age 40 and older over the course of 35 years. They found cardiovascular problems to be more prevalent among those who had at least one of four signs of aging: receding hairline at the temples, baldness at the crown of the head, creases in the earlobes, or yellow fatty deposits around the eyes. People with three of the markers were 57% more likely to have a heart attack and 39% more likely to have heart disease, even if they had no conventional heart disease risk factors, such as excessive weight, high cholesterol, elevated blood pressure, or a family history of heart disease. The heart disease risk was even greater for people over 70 who looked older than others their age. The findings should give clinicians greater incentive to treat patients who show these physical signs. Anne Hansen of the University of Copenhagen tells ABCNews.com, researchers aren't sure what links those four aging markers with heart disease. Other common signs of aging, such as wrinkles and graying hair, don't appear to have a significant correlation with heart health. The next article from the Health and Science section, The Pain of Math. Difficulties with math, from balancing a checkbook to tallying a tip, can cause some people to feel genuine pain. That's the finding of a new study that examined the brains of people with high levels of math anxiety as they performed algebra problems. While the volunteers waited to receive each question, a region of the brain involved in processing physical pain became especially active. That region, the dorsoposterior insula, is part of the evolutionary ancient pain system that triggers the hurt we feel, for instance, when we burn our hands on the stove, University of Chicago psychologist Cyan Bellick tells NBCNews.com. The same region also appears to register intense emotional anguish, like the feelings surrounding a bad breakup. Among those who fear math, the region lights up when they merely think about the subject, causing them to feel similar distress, a sensation that is bound to reinforce their math anxieties. But surprisingly, the dorsoposterior insula became active only while volunteers waited to receive their next problem, not while they were actually doing it. It is not that math itself hurts, Bellick and her colleagues reason. Rather, merely the anticipation of math is painful. Another article from the Health and Science section, Learning to Lose Weight. Good week to be talking about this one, I would say. Practicing weight-watching skills before you start a diet may be the key to keeping weight off for good. A new Stanford University study suggests that learning how to maintain your current weight without trying to shed pounds helps prevent you from gaining back lost pounds later. Researchers put more than 250 overweight women into two groups. In one, women began dieting right away by eating healthier foods and exercising. In the other, women were asked not to lose any weight, but merely to spend 8 weeks working on weight maintenance skills, such as weighing themselves daily and being mindful of portion sizes and calorie intake. That practice run allowed the women to work out the kinks involved in maintaining a regular weight without the pressure of worrying about how much weight they had lost, study author Michaela Kiernan tells ScienceDaily.com. After 8 weeks, they launched into the same diet program as the other group and shed roughly the same number of pounds. But in the year following their diet, they regained only half the weight that the traditional dieters did. Now we'll turn to the talking points section in the Week magazine for this week. Our first item here is entitled Women, the Election's Real Winners. The 2012 election will be remembered as the Year of the Woman, said Halima Abdullah in CNN.com. When the next Congress convenes in January, it will have 20 female senators, up from 17 today, the most in U.S. history. Those new lawmakers include pioneers like Democrats Elizabeth Warren, Massachusetts' first female senator, and Wisconsin's Tammy Baldwin, the first openly gay senator. With reproductive rights at issue, the votes of women also helped to put President Obama back in the White House. He won the support of 67% of single women and 55% of all women. Just as important as the women who won, though, were the antediluvian men who lost, said Margaret Talbot in NewYorker.com. Republicans Todd Akin and Richard Murdoch lost Senate races in Missouri and Indiana, respectively, after giving offensive explanations of why women impregnated during rape should be compelled by law to give birth. If there really was a war on women, it looks like the women are winning. Excuse me if I don't break out the champagne, said Abby Rappaport in Prospect.org. This whole crazy idea that women can govern might be catching on, but gender parity remains a distant dream. In state legislatures, women still hold only about 25% of the seats, while the number of female governors just fell from 6 to 4 out of 50. And what's missing from this all-girl power talk is a mention of how poorly the Republican women fared, said Susanna Schachow in Politico.com. Republican women simply don't run for Congress in the same numbers as Democratic women. This year, just 109 Republican women sought House seats compared with 190 Democratic women. So long as the GOP remains an old boys club, women will remain a minority in state capitals and in Washington. Still, this year's election could mark a real turning point, said Ann Friedman in NYMag.com. Studies show that when one woman is elected to the Senate, the chances of another woman being elected go way up. Voters get comfortable seeing high-profile women like Warren in power, and ambitious women have more role models to emulate. Someday, when women hold roughly 50% of the seats at all levels of government, we'll be able to declare the Year of the Woman. But if we made it that far, I'm pretty sure we probably won't be using the label anymore. And our next article, the Democrats, a lasting majority? Told you so, said Rye Texera in TheAtlantic.com. A decade ago, my co-author John Judas and I predicted in our book, The Emerging Democratic Majority, that the shifting demographics of America would usher in an era of dominance for the Democratic Party. That era began last Tuesday. Despite a moribund economy and a fired-up and well-funded opposition, Democrats not only retained the White House, but gained seats in the House and Senate. Why? They got lopsided support from minorities, single women, and educated professionals, three Democratic blocs whose numbers will only grow in coming years. Obamacare will add to the Democrats' advantage, said Alan Draper in MarketWatch.com. By 2016, at least 30 million newly insured Americans are likely to identify with the Democratic Party who provided these benefits. At the same time, younger voters lean left on social issues such as gay rights. Add it all up, and we could be looking at a new Democratic majority for the foreseeable future. Be highly skeptical of such predictions, said Megan McArdle in the DailyBeast.com. Texera and Judas wrote their book in 2002, and in 2004 and 10, the Democrats were crushed at the polls. Democrats barely won this year, even though the stiff and flip-flopping Romney was a uniquely bad candidate. Now President Obama and the Democrats have to address the deficit and the looming entitlement crisis, which will force them to own some very tough choices that will pit seniors, the young, and the middle class against one another and pry some of them loose from the Democrats' grip. By 2016, Obama will be out of the picture, said Abe Greenwald in CommentaryMagazine.com. We'll see how Democrats do without the personality cult, that is, that won them the last two elections. And now, as we reach the end of our program, a couple of short articles from Talking Points. Americans from at least 20 states have petitioned the White House since Election Day to let their state secede from the Union. The states include Colorado, Florida, and New York, but Texas's petition is the most popular, with more than 80,000 signatories. Men and women who've served in the military have about double the infidelity rate of non-veterans, with about 32% admitting to extramarital sex at some point, according to a national study. The growing supply of oil within the U.S., which has been made available by fracking and other new technologies, will enable America to surpass Saudi Arabia as the world's largest producer by 2020. In the first 6 months of the year, the U.S. met 83% of its own energy needs. More Americans cast votes for Democratic House candidates last year than for Republicans, yet the GOP retained a 233-195 majority in the House, mostly because of favorable district boundaries set by Republican-controlled state legislatures. In Pennsylvania, for example, Democrats won only 5 of 18 House seats despite receiving 70,000 more votes in aggregate than the Republicans. And now we'll take a look at the poll watch for this week. In the wake of President Obama's reelection, just 33% of Americans support repealing his health care reform law. That's the lowest support for repeal since the law was passed. And 94% of dog owners and 91% of cat owners consider their pet to be a member of their family. Well, we're just about finished with our reading for this week, but I would like to wish you a very happy Thanksgiving and a happy holiday weekend for you and your family, and thank you so much for your support of the Triangle Radio Reading Service. We have just about run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next week. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.